You can get 3 months of The Spectator for just £15, plus a free bottle of Paul Roger champagne if you go to spectator.co.uk/fizz24. This offer is UK only and subject to availability.
Welcome to Holy Smoke, The Spectator's religion podcast. I'm Damien Thompson. In the Christmas issue of The Spectator, the historian and novelist Ian Wilson has written an elegant, if unseasonal, essay on the extinction of mass Christianity in Britain. Do not seek false comfort from packed London congregations at the Brompton Oratory or its charismatic Anglican neighbour, Holy Trinity Brompton, he says. The real story is that regular churchgoing in England, Scotland and Wales, in wretched decline for decades, entered its terminal phase during the pandemic. Cathedrals have been swallowed by the heritage industry, which is basically how we like it. Attending Evensong is hardly more significant than tuning in to Radio 3. Yet Ian Wilson himself loyally attends Anglo-Catholic services, having rediscovered his faith a few years ago. And as you're about to hear, even today, nothing fascinates him more than the highways and byways of English churchmanship. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. You say in this devastating, very clear-eyed article that you used to think that congregations were still holding up, and this suggested that religion was not as dead as the statisticians would have us believe. But now you have your doubts. Listening to call Evensong on Radio 3 is a nice thing to do, but it's not the same thing as being religiously observant. Going to a cathedral service is surely, for many of us, only a step away from Radio 3. You acknowledge that there's tremendous vigour in the worship of the Brompton Oratory and next to it, Holy Trinity Brompton. But
these are a tiny percentage of the population.
You say,
and
you
these
say,
churches which are so-called successful, they think they're successful because they've got hundreds of people in their congregation. They don't realise, or they're trying not to realise, that there are tens of thousands of people who don't even have the faintest idea what's going on in these buildings.
Well, the statistics are pretty clear. If we look at average weekly attendance for the Church of England, I don't necessarily believe the fine print, but the overall trajectory is very, very clear. In 2009, there were about 1 million people in weekly services for the Church of England. That's now down to 650,000.
Which I would guess was a pretty optimistic statistic.
I think it could well be an optimistic statistic, because if we turn to America, which we used to think of as a religiously very different sort of society, we find a very similar pattern of secularization. Now only 20% of Americans attend church every week, but the Washington Post, I don't normally take its word for everything, but it did do a deep dive, as they say, into those statistics. And the most startling takeaway was, although 21 to 24% of us, that's Americans, say we regularly attend American religious services, research tracking people's behaviour, that's through their mobile phones, shows that the number may be as small as 5%. So, as you say, the figure of 650,000 may well indeed be very optimistic.
Also, the other thing you've got to do, which is difficult if you're a statistician to do, but you and I can do it, and anybody listening to this can do it, there are pockets, London being the most obvious, large pockets, in England, where churchgoing still goes on, but there are whole tracts of the British Isles where actually churchgoing hardly ever happens as a regular practice.
Absolutely.
Scotland is most obvious. I mean, they've closed now about half the Church of Scotland churches. Wales is pretty bad. All the chapels have closed, nearly all of them. And most parts of England, you would be hard pushed to find a weekday Eucharist within 25 miles of where you are standing or sitting.
And there's one very striking way of illustrating the crisis of church attendance in the countryside, and that's by looking at the number of children who attend Church of England services. The Diocese of Canterbury had 1,600 children in Sunday worship in 2019. By
2022, it had 1,000, nearly a 40% drop. Hereford dropped from 500 to 400 children in all of its churches. It only has 399 churches. Therefore, it's been suggested it's likely that Hereford has more church buildings than it has children inside them on an average Sunday across the entire diocese. And of course, if children are not going to church, that does indeed suggest, as you do in your magnificent article, that the future of Christianity may become like, I don't know, the future of Platonism.
That was the analogy I drew, that actually, although Plato's Academy went on remarkably long, it went on till the Emperor Justinian abolished it, it was in effect dead, of course, for years beforehand. There's a very good image in an Austrian novel called The Man Without Qualities by Robert Musil, Der Mann ohne Eigenschaften. It's written post-First World War, but it's set just before the outbreak of the First World War. And it describes the enthusiasm of the crowds for their old emperor. And they believe that there's light and effulgence shining from the emperor. They almost believe in his divinity. What they don't realize, he said, is that it's like the brightness of a star that you see in the night sky that actually died millions of years before. And I think that's what's happened, certainly in relation to the Church of England and perhaps in relation to institutional Christianity in Europe generally.
I wanted to ask you, from your perspective as a historian, when was the last time that England was a fervently religious society? And can I just set out my little take on it? Perhaps it was on the eve of the Reformation, when you had a growth in pilgrimages and also a growth in private piety that was nurtured by printing.
Which is all magnificently written about in the stripping of the altars.
It is indeed. It is indeed. But then so many expressions of piety were banned. And after that, you could argue that any religious growth in England or Britain was sectarian or revivalist or driven by Catholic immigration. And that the norm was the placid, taken-for-granted parish life described by, say, Parson Woodford, who's a great favourite of mine. I love his diaries. Who would read services dutifully without expecting or wanting it to provoke fervent displays of public piety. But then, and you're a specialist in the Victorian era, I wanted to ask you about this. You do have the phenomenon of massive Victorian church building, especially, almost exclusively, an urban phenomenon, especially in London. Much of it is the expression of high church or evangelical enthusiasm that had the character of a mission to the English people and significantly never established itself in the countryside. Or am I wrong? Was there a genuine revival of religious fervour in England during the Victorian period that we see now in all these empty Victorian churches?
Well, let's limit ourselves to the 19th century because it's relatively recent. I totally agree with you. I have enormous fondness for the 18th century Church of England with the box pews. And I mean, Dr. Johnson, who was regarded as very pious, was amazed that Boswell said that he'd been to communion, that is to say, more than once a year, and congratulated him upon it. I mean, it was the levels of church going and piety, so-called, in the 18th century were more or less nil by modern standards. I remember going for a walk. This is a sort of answer to your question, and then I'll answer it in more detail. I had a friend who was an Anglo-Catholic priest who died aged 101. So he'd been a priest in Bethnal Green and in London Docks during the 1920s. And I remember going for a walk with him through Bethnal Green, and he was in his 90s, but still very vigorous, and looking at these huge Victorian brick churches, saying, it must have been so wonderful when you were a young man, people crowding into high mass and all that sort of thing. And he laughed cynically, in a way that only Anglo-Catholics can laugh cynically, and said, you don't realise why these places were built. Nobody, but nobody, ever came to them. They were meant to demonstrate to the Darwinians and the secularists who were living in the West End that religion had been revived in the East End. And obviously we, the Anglo-Catholics, hoped that people would go. Yes, if there was a big ceremony, a sort of Corpus Christi or something, all the Anglo-Catholics in the East End would go to that one particular church, and then the next time, you know, the patronal festival or something, they'd all crowd into the other one. But the churches were never full, never.
That's interesting. And of course, funerals. The Cray twins came from an Anglo-Catholic East End background.
Very much so.
So I think they had Anglo-Catholic funerals.
But the funerals were big, and a lot of people think Max Miller in Brighton, the famous smutty comedian,
yes,
the master of double entendre, must have been Jewish because he was funny, but actually he was Romany stock. And he said to another friend of mine, who was an Anglo-Catholic priest in Brighton, I don't go to church very much, Father, but I go on the great ceremonies to St. Bartholomew's. And so there were quite a lot of people, I think, Anglo-Catholic-minded people who went.
This is St. Bartholomew's in Brighton.
Yes.
It's built to resemble the Ark.
It was built to resemble the Ark by a man called Wagner.
Yes, that's
His
right.
father was the vicar of Brighton and famously preached a sermon on the text, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is a lunatic, because the younger Mr. Wagner, known as Father Wagner by everybody, built these extraordinarily high churches.
The Wagner churches of Brighton.
The Wagner
St.
churches.
St. Paul's, St. Michael's. They're all empty now.
They're all empty. And I think, actually, Brighton being Brighton and unusual, I think they were popular. People did used to go to those churches. Mr. Wagner, of course, Father Wagner, was the famous person who heard the Confession of Constance Kent, you know, that Kate Summerfield so brilliantly wrote about, and who'd murdered her little brother, her stepbrother, and he wouldn't give her absolution until she'd given herself up to the police. It was a very famous Victorian
case. There were
case.
These little pockets of Anglo-Catholicism,
yes,
outside London. Well, they called it London and South Coast religion, didn't they?
They did.
So Brighton and
Eastbourne.
Oxford, obviously, but Reading, where I had the misfortune to grow up, was packed with empty Anglo-Catholic churches, one of them run by my dear friend, Canon Brian Brindley, as he was at the time, who staged services of baroque splendour in this tiny, very undistinguished Gothic box.
Which felt full because everybody crowded in, but of course it was tiny, as you say.
It was tiny, yes. But it had the rude screen.
But you see,
from Birmingham Cathedral crammed into it.
It did, St. Chad's, the Roman Catholic
That's
Cathedral.
Right, yes.
I think we should recognise that there was a glory age in the Church of England, which is a historical anomaly I can't explain myself. During and after the First World War, quite a lot of intellectually minded people like T.S. Eliot, C.S. Lewis, and so forth became very vociferous, very articulate Christian intellectuals in the public sphere. And they did go to church, and this coincided with a period where church going went up. And in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, church going was quite popular in England. And a lot of these churches, which you rightly say, weren't full in the 19th century when they were built. They were built as propaganda exercises, were used.
Which is interesting because the heyday of American church going was also the 1950s. It made you think that maybe it was a badge of middle class identity to some extent. More, I think, perhaps in America.
I think it's an historical anomaly because historically, as we're rightly suggesting, certainly in Britain and America, before the 19th century, and to a large extent during the 19th century, churchgoing wasn't popular. You remember in his memoirs, G.K. Chesterton, who was part of what I'm describing, the post-First World War phenomenon, he said that the religion of his parents' generation, the Victorians, was agnosticism or atheism. They all believed Charles Darwin.
And I find it very interesting that religious revival, certainly in England, perhaps it's not true of Wales, but religious revival has never taken off in the countryside, and fervent religion since the Reformation has never been part of English country life, even though the parish church has been very important. I remember, I forget who it was who said, I think it was one of those Catholic intellectuals that you were referring to, who said, I'll believe in the conversion of England when a single English village goes over to Rome. And of course, it has never happened. And it didn't happen in the early 1990s when hundreds of Anglican clergy became Catholic priests, but were almost without exception unable to bring their people with them. Because Anglo-Catholicism was basically a clericalist movement.
It always has been. And also the other thing about Anglo-Catholicism, which optimistic Roman Catholics never understand, because they always think it looks and sounds so like Roman Catholicism that all you have to do is make an arrangement, like the so-called Ordinariate, which makes it very, very easy for Anglicans to go on being Anglicans, but within the Roman Catholic umbrella. What they don't realise is that Anglo-Catholicism is basically congregationalism.
Oh, very much so. And there's a tremendous rivalry between congregations.
It's run from church to church. They're almost independent churches. And they have the congregationalist habit of wanting to sack the vicar. They don't actually have the power that congregationalist elders used to have of actually sacking their ministers. But they do in effect, because if they ostracize Father, because he's done something tremendously un-Catholic, as they would believe, then he's finished.
Do you think that the ordination of women in 1994 has had any effect on levels of church going or the character of the Church of England? Because if you turn on a Church of England Sunday service, you know, on the telly, it's nearly always conducted by a woman.
Yes.
So it seems as if there has been a tremendous feminization of the Church of England. Many people would say it's benefited from that, but it certainly hasn't benefited from it statistically.
Well,
what do you think?
It's very difficult to say when something happens and then something else happens. Was it the result? Are we talking about causation or are there two events? I mean, I think they ordained women as a sign of desperation. They knew within themselves that they weren't ever going to have enough men to ordain, which will happen very likely in the Western Church generally, I think. When you look at Ireland, which used to be the branch of the Roman Catholic Church that fed America, Africa and England with its priests, has now almost no candidates for ordination, almost no aspirant priests.
They have closed their seminary in Rome.
They've closed the Irish College. It's just quite extraordinary. So I think that's what happened when they ordained women in the Church of England. I don't think they were necessarily fervent feminists, as the Americans were. The Americans did it for feminist reasons. They did it for optimistic reasons. I think in many respects, the English bishops did it for cynical reasons. It's extremely difficult to know. What they did do by ordaining women was to splinter and wreck the Anglo-Catholic idea. Because on the one hand, there were Anglo-Catholics who could almost say, the Pope is about to understand us and about to recognise our orders. Of course, this was a fantasy. Or at least I believe it was a fantasy, but because the papal bull denying the validity of Anglican orders still stands, nobody's revoked it. The Orthodox might be very polite when they meet an Anglican bishop, but I don't think they've ever really believed that the Church of England was a church in their sense of the word. But it was nevertheless possible for learned, ecumenically minded Anglican scholars to meet up with the Orthodox and the Catholics to believe that their episcopate, the bishops of the Church of England, were bishops in the same sense that the Pope is a bishop or that the ecumenical patriarch is a bishop. Once you'd ordained women, and particularly once you'd consecrated them to the episcopate, it was no longer possible to entertain this, even as a pious fantasy, because they very fervently said, and very clearly said, both the Pope and the Orthodox, all the Orthodox and the Copts, that they no longer had any time whatsoever for the Church of England. They might be polite when they met the Archbishop of Canterbury and smile and shake hands, but they didn't believe the Church of England was part of the universal church.
Well, I agree with you, though it's a bizarre development that ecclesiology seems to have collapsed under this pontificate. This Pope doesn't want women priests, but has told a number of Anglican or non-Catholic bishops thinking of converting, oh, don't bother, you're already a bishop. He's not very interested in ecclesiology or the validity of order.
He might have said,
just not one of his things.
He might have said that, but and he might well have said don't bother in individual cases, but the line hasn't changed.
You're quite right.
And therefore, if you were an observant, pious Catholic Anglican, realising that there was that the line hadn't changed, and therefore the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox churches don't really recognise the bishops of the Church of England as bishops anymore, then it would put you in a very troubling position. Because although you would believe that there was a merciful God who was going to absolve sins of people who had been to confession to an Anglican priest, of course nobody's thinking, well, very few maniacs might be thinking, that God was withholding grace from the Church of England. Nevertheless, it's impossible to regard the Church of England as canonically bound in any way to the universal church. It's adrift because of women priests. And therefore you've got this rather absurd situation in the Church of England of a little band of them being given very generous provisions by the rest of the Church of England that they can huddle away in ultra-spiky, lacy churches and not ever have to admit that their bishop is a, for example, many of these churches are in London, that their bishop is a woman. They can have some flying bishop who pretends to be their bishop.
I think that's going to fall apart quickly. Because
it won't
have the ridiculous situation where the Bishop of Fulham has, you know, well, Bishop Sarah makes a point of attending all these churches that don't recognise her as a bishop. Admittedly, not dressed in episcopal robes.
She dresses as if for the
choir dress.
She dresses as if for the House of Lords.
Yes.
When she goes to these places.
I suppose you could argue that one benefit of the relaxed, easygoing, Parson Woodford nature of English rural Christianity is that because the church was never established in the way that it was in continental Europe, the Catholic Church was in continental Europe, or Ireland, or indeed Lutheranism, or the Kirk was in Scotland, you don't have this poisonous anti-clericalism that now seems to be driving so much of public life in, for example, the Republic of Ireland.
Yes, you don't have it. I quite agree with you. By the way, I'm not completely sure you're right about... I think the Church of England is so good at fudge and so good at maintaining absurd situations that these Anglo-Catholic parishes I've described will probably be allowed to go on. And, of course, they are, very many of them, wonderful places that are looking after the most marginalised and disadvantaged parts of our society. So, I mean, that's another reason why I think the Church of England will hesitate before it attacks.
But don't you think that they might, as has indeed happened in a number of previously very spiky churches, just quietly accommodate women priests?
Well, as people get, as the new generations come through, younger priests, I think they just won't, there won't be enough Anglo-Catholic priests who think as the old ones did. And so I think you're right about that.
I mean, St. Stephen's House, where you were yourself an ordinand, now has no problem with women priests, or at least
It has tremendous problems, actually. I mean, I once wrote a scandalous novel about St. Stephen's House, but somebody should be writing one.
Very, a little masterpiece,
anyway,
I
thank
have
you.
To say.
But anyway, somebody should write the one about what goes on there now, because it is incroyable. Because they do have, you're perfectly correct, they are training women to become priests, but they also have a smaller group of men who don't regard the women ordinands as human beings, as far as I can tell. And they do the most appalling things to one another. And they, at the end of the academic year, when little invitations, pious invitations are put into everybody's pigeonhole, please come and attend my ordination or my being raised to the diaconate or whatever word you call it. Please come to my first mass and all those things. The things which are done to those invitation cards, the emendations, to put it mildly, are unspeakable.
Yes, but bitchiness is part of the DNA of St. Stephen's House, isn't it?
There's bitchiness, but there's also insanity.
So if I could be...
But there's, we've got into very, very murky waters
well,
here, whereas we were
so
trying
rude
to...
It's to ask, I mean, you are, having been through a period of not being a believer, having been, you were briefly a Roman Catholic, weren't you, as a young man?
Yes.
Having been an Anglican ordinand, having written from the perspective of an agnostic, having returned to faith... What is it that keeps you going to church services when you can see the signs of decline all around you?
I have to admit, if I asked myself that question, part of it is defiance of the secularism of the age, the consumerism of the age. I think it's a very good way of trying to resist the consumerism of the age and the unthinking secularism of public discourse. But it's not just to be silly and to be defiant that I go. I believe it, that's why I go. I believe that the incarnate God walked on this earth and left a token of his everlasting presence here, which was the Eucharist, and therefore you've got to go to Holy Communion.
Aidan Wilson, thank you very much.